From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Florida Governor Rick Scott is warning residents along the Florida Panhandle to hunker down as Hurricane Michael is expected to make landfall as a Category 4 storm in the coming hours.
Now the storm is here, it is not safe to travel across the Panhandle. If you are in a coastal area, do not leave your house. The time to evacuate in coastal areas has come and gone.
Joining us now is meteorologist Jeff Huffman with the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Jeff, where is Hurricane Michael right now?
Jeremy, we're looking at the center of the storm. I mean, the middle of the eye. It's 27 miles from Tyndall Air Force Base. It's about 32 miles from Panama City. But the eye wall, where the destructive and almost catastrophic winds are, is only sitting about 8 miles offshore. So we're looking at conditions incredibly deteriorating in the next hour or two, right along the coast there from Mexico Beach to Panama City in Florida's Panhandle.
And when will it make landfall? In the next hour or two?
Probably, well, it's all about the eye wall. When that comes ashore is when the conditions get their worst, and that's going to be in the next hour or two. The center is probably going to make landfall between 2 and 4 p.m. this afternoon, probably very close to Tyndall Air Force Base, which is just to the southeast of Panama City.
What impacts are being felt so far?
Well, I want to give our listeners around the nation some perspective on this. Winds are at 150 miles per hour. That's from the National Hurricane Center. The official top wind speed at landfall from Hurricane Andrew in 1992 was 155 miles per hour. This is a storm that is not weakening in the next couple of hours. I would say we're going to see sustained winds. There's a really good chance we're going to see sustained winds across a large area of the coastline of 120 to 150 miles per hour in that range. That is going to cause structure failure across many structures. We've been telling our audiences from the NPR WKGC station in Panama City that this is not just a move inside type of storm. This is a move to your interior room, find a mattress, find a bike helmet, protect your head. If you're in a surge area, and we know from the officials that many folks ignored the evacuation warnings there, they need to also think about moving to the second level of your home, but also still find a way to protect yourself because you have to take your preparations in the next few minutes to the extreme level in those areas. I'm talking Gulf and Bay counties and Franklin counties there in the Panhandle of Florida.
The FEMA Administrator Brock Long said in a news conference today that not only Florida but also Georgia needs to be prepared to see the power out maybe for multiple weeks. He said another unfortunate aspect about Hurricane Michael is the rainfall that's going to be associated with the storm as it pushes through. Let's listen.
Hopefully the forward speed of the storm will reduce the amount of rainfall that South Carolina and North Carolina sees. But as you all know, Florence passed through the Cape Fear River and other river basins have yet to recede back to normal river levels, and any amount of rainfall through South and North Carolina is not welcomed.
So, Jeff, obviously the people who need to be paying attention at this very minute are the people there along the Florida Panhandle, but what about people who are in Georgia and the Carolinas? What should they be thinking about?
Well, because this storm now is quite a bit stronger than earlier forecast, and it's still moving at a pretty good pace, it's not going to fall apart as quickly. So even it's now forecast to stay a Category 2 hurricane crossing I-10, which is just along the Panhandle there near Tallahassee and just to the west, and it will stay a hurricane probably for about 100 miles up into South Georgia. So we're looking at a wide swath of wind damage. Picture the destruction you might have seen close to it from Hurricane Andrew, and then also think about how far inland Charley came back in 2004 to Orlando, and we could see a very wide swath of a lot of damage from this. And then when you talk about the rainfall in South and North Carolina, it's a little early for exact numbers there, but unfortunately it looks like the path will take the heaviest rain over some of the hardest hit areas from Florence tomorrow and into Friday.
So just a few seconds left here, Jeff, but your one message to people who are listening to this along the Panhandle.
If you still have power and you still have and you still can obviously hear me, you have a few more minutes to make really some life-saving decisions. And like I mentioned a few seconds ago, you need to bring everything that you need in the next 12 hours to survive close to you, within arm's reach, and you need to move to an interior room and you need to find something to protect your head. We have not seen winds like this come ashore in a populated area from a hurricane in several years.
Right.
One of the almost worst case scenarios for this area.
It's Jeff Huffman. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Turkish media showed images today of what it's calling a 15-member assassination squad, allegedly sent to target Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi when he arrived at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul last Tuesday. The kingdom has called the allegations that it either murdered or abducted Khashoggi baseless, but it hasn't yet provided any evidence that he left the consulate, and Khashoggi hasn't been seen since last Tuesday. Aaron David Miller is director of the Middle East program at the Wilson Center. He's also a former Middle East advisor to past Republican and Democratic administrations. Aaron, welcome back. You know Jamal Khashoggi and consider him a friend.
We've had conversations over the years. He's participated in Wilson Center programs. But I liked Jamal. He was easy to like. He had a great sense of humor. He was a damn good journalist, a man of profound integrity and courage. And I think above all, and this is the paradox, I think, a man who was a Saudi patriot and a Saudi nationalist, but who had profound doubts about the behavior both at home and abroad of the current Saudi leadership. I would like to hope that Jamal is still alive. The indications, even though no one will confirm it publicly, and the Turks are in a very awkward position on this. They've had their sovereignty violated, and yet, at least at the moment, they don't seem that they want to pick a major fight with the Saudis right now. Nobody's confirming this. It's just all of the media reporting based on Turkish security sources and political sources seem to suggest that Jamal Khashoggi, this was premeditated, ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government.
If this is true, it would be incredibly brazen. Why do you think the Saudis would be willing to take that risk and to shoulder all of this international scrutiny just to silence one man?
I mean, it's a very good question. A message sent to dissidents abroad, and every journalist who has criticized the government of Saudi Arabia, obviously this was intended perhaps as a warning. I mean, it strains the bonds of credulity to the breaking point that even this Saudi government, which has acted, in my judgment, repressively at home, and I speak as an American here, recklessly with respect to American interests in Yemen against Qatar, that they would still be willing to risk an operation which violated Turkish sovereignty against a man who had been living in the United States, writing for the Washington Post, and frankly, whose criticism of Saudi Arabia was done in the spirit of a Saudi patriot and a Saudi nationalist. When you read what Jamal had written, it was articulated by a man who cared deeply about his country, but who was worried about the direction that it was taken, and a man who conceded that some of the reforms of the crown prince, largely, were quite positive. To me, I would say it's unimaginable, but I'm sorry to admit that it's more every day that this was Jamal's fate.
It also happened at a time when we have been reporting, unfortunately, on other examples of state-sponsored violence on foreign soil. Just yesterday, we learned more about the identity of the Russian intelligence officer who was accused of poisoning a former spy in the UK. When you add all of this up, what you're seeing around the world, does it represent to you at all a breakdown of international order?
Some would argue that it represents an increasingly lawless world where international norms are wantonly violated without any recourse to bringing any of these individuals to justice. Others would argue that this is the way of the world. It's been this way for a very long time. Nations calibrate their interests ruthlessly, pragmatically, without much regard for principle. Again, I care most about the United States as an American. Well, and here I think there is a serious issue. I mean, the American administrations, and I worked for a half a dozen secretaries of state of both political parties, Republicans and Democrats, have long, in the interests of the United States, maintained very close relationships with Saudi Arabia.
And let's talk about that. Khashoggi's fiance wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post begging, essentially, President Trump to do something about this. As you just said, not only the Trump administration, but other administrations have been loath to confront the Saudis about human rights abuses. I mean, what can the Trump administration do? And what do you think they will do?
At a minimum, we need a full accounting of the Saudi role. We've touted Saudi Arabia and the senior leaders of this of Saudi Arabia, the Crown Prince in particular, as a reformer, a moderate man who envisions a different future for his country. And we have leverage. President Trump reportedly said to King Salman several weeks ago, "You wouldn't last 2 weeks if it wasn't for the U.S. military." And I think the threat, the consequence, is that the future of the U.S.-Saudi relationship is really at stake here. Now, does the administration want to go down that road? The preliminary indications are the answer is no. The president is now has joined himself to Mr. Putin, who eliminates his rivals abroad. And now we have serious accusations that another American partner, the Saudis, are doing the same thing. And that's not good. As an American, that's not good for America.
Aaron David Miller of the Wilson Center, thank you.
Welcome back, everybody. We have breaking news coming to us out of California, San Bernardino, where we have the sheriff's office confirming that they've had an active shooter where they have at least 20 victims of this shooter in an area.
That was December 2nd, 2015. The terror attack would claim 14 lives and injure 22, including Julie Paez, who was shot twice after her coworker opened fire during an office Christmas party. 6 months later, we met Paez at her home, where she showed us some of the mementos she received during her recovery, including a Star of Hope from one of her nurses.
These are the things that get me choked up, the nice people. So he runs marathons, and every time he runs a marathon, he saves them for people he comes across. So, I'd say congratulations, Employee of the Year, because I got an award that day for, anyway. And God bless, keep running.
We've been following her recovery ever since. Paez recently left San Bernardino for Flagstaff, Arizona, to start over. And Julie Paez joins us to talk about it. Julie, it's great to talk to you again. And why did you want to move to Flagstaff?
Well, through the county, I got a medical retirement. My husband decided to retire, and we just wanted a new start. We needed a fresh start over.
Because of what happened a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it was just really tough being there. I became separated from the county when I got my medical retirement. So I'm on my own with medical and doing things. And we just decided we wanted a kind of a smaller town, a safer atmosphere, and just a quieter, calmer life.
And what do you mean by you're on your own with medical?
Well, once I separated from the county and I was required to resign from my job. And then once the resignation took place, then I am responsible for all my medical care from here on.
Wow. And how is that working out financially?
Well, my husband has health insurance. So for me personally, it's okay. For some of my coworkers who've had to do the same thing, you know, they're paying for their own health insurance on their own now, and it's tougher. Since we talked last, I've had, I think, 5 surgeries and 7 hospitalizations. With each hospitalization, with each surgery, I had to wait for the county to approve any kind of treatment, and oftentimes they would deny, and that's like a punch to the gut. That takes the wind out of sails. So I would rather take care of my own rather than waiting for them to approve or deny treatment.
We heard so many people, and we have after every single tragedy like this, politicians come out and say, "We're going to be with you. All of the victims will help you out." Do you feel like you didn't get that help?
Absolutely. That's correct. Our county was saying we were county family and that, you know, they'll take care of us. We're county family. Really what they want, my impression, is they want to sweep us away. We were, you know, we were a stain on the county. Even for the second anniversary, they did nothing. There was nothing. They said there should be a moment of silence, you know, 11 o'clock or something. But that's it. There was no memorial. There was nothing.
Now, you have started taking classes in graphic design. You're 53 right now?
Yes.
And so how is it doing a career change?
It's different. It's something I really enjoy. So we'll see how it goes. It may or may not lead to anything. It may just be something that I do on my own that I enjoy. It may not be a real career change. I might just enjoy this retirement and spending time with my family and walking my dogs and exploring the Flagstaff, Northern Arizona area.
How are you doing physically after all those surgeries?
I think I'm doing better now. And I'm having the opportunity to go bike riding now and do much more activities. Mentally here, it's much better because it's a whole new space. It's a whole new start. From our interview, originally you had interviewed Gary Schulke, who is a sergeant with the San Bernardino mm-hmm. Police. And he got a hold of me. And we've been doing law enforcement presentations with Gary throughout the United States.
Oh, wow.
So that's actually been very healing to be able to talk and to talk to law enforcement about what happened and to get their perspective. And they like to hear from the victims and the survivors' point of view.
And you met because of our story?
Yes.
Wow.
He actually heard me on the interview and reached out to get a hold of me. And then we connected. And since we've been excellent, you know, really, really good friends. In fact, he just came through Flagstaff a couple of weeks ago and we had lunch.
Oh, great. And what do you tell people when you go around and talk about shootings?
So we tell them our experience. They want to know what they can do better. And there's a few things that they learned. Each of us had such a different perspective in that room. Where I was shot, one of my best friends, she's the one who made one of the first 911 calls. My supervisor, who's doing this also, he was our chief of our department, and he gives his perspective from a supervisor's position, watching the entire thing, but also feeling responsible for everyone in the room. So each person sort of has their own niche of what they experienced and what was running through their mind and how law enforcement really, how they can improve their responses for the victim side. Hmm. I know quite a few of my coworkers, all they saw was law enforcement, their boots. And in their mind, they thought this was the bad guys coming to shoot them. And so, you know, the law enforcement hadn't really thought about that, that just the shoes, someone seeing their shoes alone would make people assume they were bad.
I recently met a teacher from Parkland High School in Florida who mm-hmm. had run into the building to help save people during that shooting. And after I found that out about him, I didn't know what to say to him. For several minutes, I sat there and I just didn't even know, do I thank him? Do I say great job or whatever? When people meet you and find out what you've been through, what are those interactions like?
Usually they're surprised that I'm outwardly not more injured, that they can't tell from looking at me with my clothes on and just walking around that I was shot twice. I think they expect to see someone much more crippled, maybe even looking more emotionally crippled, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So typically they're more shocked that I went through that and I'm standing there looking kind of too normal to them.
Is it difficult for you to talk to them about what happened?
It's not now. I think thanks to these presentations that I've done, it's actually been really healthy to repeat the story and to say the story. It's become more maybe, I don't know, natural, or it's allowed me to remove myself a little bit from it. I think it's been very healing for me.
There have been so many other shootings since we last spoke.
Yes.
Have your views changed at all on, or have you developed any idea about what could be done to stop these from happening?
No, I it's so frustrating to me. And it just always seems that the ease of obtaining weapons here, but especially the weapons like the AR-15s and these weapons that are made to hunt human beings. Really, that's what they're made for. They're not made for going and sport shooting or hunting. These are made for hunting humans. And it's frustrating to me that they're so readily available in this country, because it seems that all of the shootings, these mass shootings, have involved that type of weapon.
And do you think that anything will be done about that?
I don't think anything is going to be done anytime soon, unfortunately, no.
When we talked to you in 2016, you showed us some of the things that people had given you to help you recover, a star of hope and a medal given to you after the attack by one of your nurses. Do you still have those things?
Yes, and actually, Dexter, the nurse, I presented him with a star of hope. He's a huge blood donor for the blood bank. For Lifestream in San Bernardino, and I became a spokesman for them, or spokesperson. And he's, you know, one of these over 100-gallon club guys who has given for years and years. So on his, to mark his 100th gallon, they had a special ceremony and invited me, and I gave him a special Star of Hope. So I'm also doing the Stars of Hope and sending them to other communities. With my daughter's school last year, I got Stars of Hope for all of the kids to paint that then went to another tragedy. It was a mass shooting that were sent to, they were sent to Texas. So Dexter, that's the nurse, I have been in touch with him. He's just special to me. And the Stars of Hope I'm still involved with. And their founder, Jeff Parnas, and I have become good friends also through all of this.
That is Julie Paez, who was shot at the office Christmas party in San Bernardino County back in 2015. 14 people were killed, 22 injured. Julie, it's great to talk to you again. I'm so glad that, you know, you've gotten a new start there in Arizona, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you, Jeremy.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The vaccine for human papillomavirus, or HPV, has been approved for men and women between the ages of 27 and 45. That's expanded from the previous recommendations that included only kids and young adults between 9 and 26. The HPV virus causes cervical cancers in women, penile and neck cancers in men, but the vaccine has been shown to be 88% effective. Dr. Jessica Shepherd practices obstetrics and gynecology at Baylor University in Dallas. Dr. Shepherd, welcome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Did the FDA make the right choice to expand the age range of this vaccine?
Oh, absolutely. I think that choice was very much desired, especially from, you know, health providers and just from, you know, the health industry, seeing that the amount of cancers that are HPV driven have been increasing. It definitely allows more people to be covered. And really, it doesn't limit people to, you know, the age of 26, which is previously when it stopped.
We're reading that 80 million Americans are infected with some form of HPV and that 14 million new people contract it every year. So why was it ever limited to just kids and young adults in the first place?
So looking at studies, especially when you're submitting to the FDA for approval for a new medication or a drug, is really there has to be an endpoint. And so initially when they're looking at reproductive age and the risk of cervical cancers, 11 through 13 is when they started to try and capture adolescents before there is any sexual intercourse or activity from decreasing the risk of contracting that virus. And so now what we've seen over the years is that they will have increase in broad range of age in order to give more people the vaccine because they have such good outcome.
Now, if you're between 27 and 45, you're more likely to be in a monogamous relationship. So who in that group do you recommend should get that vaccine?
You know, and that's the misperception, is that, you know, people are more likely to be in a monogamous relationship. Not always true, but the thing about HPV is it can be contracted very early. And again, the symptoms of it are not typically what you would see with a virus. So many people don't know that they're carrying the virus. And so it can be transmitted to any partner at any time in life. And so if you have the ability for, again, people outside of that age range now that they're capturing after the age of 26 up to the age of 45, then that's great, because the transmission of the virus can be decreased significantly. It's just able to protect more people and also decrease the amount of HPV cancers, because actually the risk of HPV cancers have been increasing over the last few years.
Some parents have said that they don't want to vaccinate their child because they think it could encourage promiscuity. Do you think that expanding this age range will encourage some families to put off the vaccines for children, let them do it later in life if they want to? And would that be a problem?
Yeah, that would be potentially one of the outcomes of expanding the age range. But what we do know from studies is that the earlier that you have this vaccine, it can decrease your risk of having transmission of the virus. Now, when you get older, you can still have this virus, but what we're looking at is actually the decrease of it causing any of the cancers that you mentioned earlier. Even if you have had the HPV virus in the past, it still can decrease your risk of getting an actual cancer from the HPV virus.
Dr. Jessica Shepherd practices obstetrics and gynecology at Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas. Dr. Shepherd, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm broadcasting from Southern California this week, where Democrats hope to flip 4 Republican House seats. Voters in California are also electing a new governor and deciding whether to reelect longtime Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein. Joining us now are 2 journalists who cover politics in California. From San Francisco, we've got Scott Schaefer, senior editor for KQED. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy.
And with me in the studio at KPCC in Pasadena is Mary Plummer, who's political correspondent for KPCC. Hi, Mary.
Hey there.
So let's start with the governor's race. Jerry Brown is not able to run again because of term limits. The race is between his lieutenant governor, Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, and Republican businessman John Cox. Scott, you just moderated the first and possibly only debate this week on KQED. Let's listen to a little of what Gavin Newsom said first.
The California dream is predicated on social mobility, the richest and the poorest state. We have to mine that gap. We have to address the issue of cost of housing. We have to address the issue of affordability broadly. We have to address the issue of homelessness, and we have to tackle the vexing issue of health care and the issues related to health care that are devouring the state budget.
And here's Republican John Cox.
I have a vision of this state being affordable and livable for people. I think we can do that if we get rid of the special interest influence in Sacramento. The interest groups that inhabit Sacramento benefit from the status quo. The status quo isn't working for average working Californians. They can't afford to live here, and that's why they're leaving.
Sounds like they both agree that California is getting to be unaffordable for a lot of people. Scott, Newsom has a big lead in the polls. Does Cox have a chance?
Well, it's tough. The math is tough for him. The last time a Republican won a statewide race in California, 2006, his name was Arnold Schwarzenegger. And the Republicans have just seen their share of the electorate shrinking. They're now literally a third party in California. Democrats are about 44% of the electorate, declined to state, independent voters, no party preference voters, 27%. And the GOP now down to about 25%, just a quarter of the electorate. So in order for somebody like John Cox to win, he has to have a lot of appeal to independent voters and some conservative Democrats. And so we just really haven't seen that yet in the polling. I mean, it's just a tough place California is for Republicans to win statewide.
If Newsom wins, Mary, will it be basically like another term for Jerry Brown or different?
You know, Governor Brown has been very aggressive against many of President Trump's policies. And Newsom has indicated he'd take a similar approach, especially on issues like, you know, immigration, health care, environmental issues. Newsom supports sanctuary cities, for example. He backs California becoming a zero carbon emissions state. But there are a couple areas where he's indicated he'd be willing to invest more heavily than Brown has. One of those areas is early childhood. During the recession, state funding for programs like infant toddler care and preschool was severely cut. Those funds have not been restored under Governor Jerry Brown. Newsom has indicated he'd be willing to invest more heavily there. We're seeing that issue reflected in TV ads that he's running as well.
Well, and as you mentioned, Jerry Brown has gone up against President Trump. The state has sued the Trump administration more than a dozen times over everything from environmental issues to immigration. President Trump slammed California right back. Here he is earlier this year at an event touting his plan for a border wall.
No, I think the governor's doing a terrible job running the state of California. And, you know, hey, I have property in California, I will say. I don't think too much about my property anymore, but I have great property in California. The taxes are way, way out of whack. And people are going to start to move pretty soon. And if you don't have safety, meaning if you don't have this kind of wall, the drugs are pouring through in California. Can't do it.
Scott, there are several congressional races in California that are up for grabs this year. How is President Trump playing in the state as voters prepare to go to the polls next month?
Well, in like a lot of blue states, Jeremy, Donald Trump is not popular in California. I mean, Hillary Clinton got more than 3 million more votes than Donald Trump did, and he's still way underwater. Last statewide poll showed him at about 30% approval rating, maybe a little higher among likely voters. So I'm not sure the Republicans who are running, the incumbents running for re-election, or the challengers or the newcomers running for open seats necessarily want Donald Trump out here. Their problem in these really close races is going to be appealing to independent voters, and Donald Trump does not do well with them. He is not going to be helpful to these Republican candidates in persuading them to vote for the Republican in these congressional races.
And Mary, what are the issues that those independent voters are thinking about? This is a state that, like the rest of the country right now, has a pretty low unemployment rate. If anything, the problem is people can't find the workers that they need to fill the jobs. It's not like that's a major issue, but obviously affordability is big. What else?
Affordability, homelessness. Here in the LA area, we're dealing with a massive homeless crisis. That's an issue that we've seen play out in the governor's race and also in the congressional races. You know, there are just issues of affordability that I think a lot of these no party preference voters, which is what we call the unaffiliated voters here in California, care really deeply about.
Let's talk about the Senate race in California that's going on. Longtime Senator Dianne Feinstein is facing another Democrat because in California, the top two vote getters face each other in the general election. State Senator Kevin DeLeon is the one facing Feinstein. And Feinstein is weathering some criticism for her handling of the Kavanaugh hearing. She's the ranking member on the Judiciary Committee. Here she is during the hearings.
This isn't a political battle for power, as some have said. This is a serious undertaking with serious allegations.
Scott, is she vulnerable?
Maybe. Certainly, she's been ahead in every poll. She won every single county in California in the June primary. I think Kevin DeLeon just hasn't been her challenger, the Democrat from L.A., just hasn't really gotten a lot of traction. He doesn't have a lot of money. The media aren't paying a lot of attention to this race. Feinstein so far has refused to debate, to give them sort of a platform to get some attention. And so it's really hard. That said, you know, I haven't seen her above 44, 46, maybe 47% in any of the polls. So and because there's two Democrats at the top of the ticket, a lot of Republicans may skip this race altogether. And that I'm not sure is going to help Feinstein, because those are people who, if they had to pick one of these two Democrats, they would probably go with her. She is more of a centrist than her opponent. So it's possible, certainly. It's not entirely clear how this Kavanaugh thing is playing for her. I've heard women very strongly defending her, that she was respecting Christine Ford. And you know, so they're not critical. But, well, you know, it's I haven't seen broad
polling.
Well,
but one thing that we have seen is that in Saturday Night Live has made fun of the fact that a lot of the people on both sides of the aisle during those Kavanaugh hearings were pretty old. She's 85 years old. He's 51. He's talked about that. He's careful about it. But he's listened to him talking to us about the fact that he says he's going to have a new generation of leadership.
I think that she subscribes to country club rules in Washington that are grossly outdated and no longer apply to California and to the rest of the country.
Mary, the age issue, is that on voters' minds?
You know, I think it is for some, especially for younger voters here in California. De Leon's arguments are certainly resonating most with the progressive side of the Democratic Party here. You know, if we rewind back to 2016, Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign had a very active group of supporters in California. Many of them were young people getting engaged in politics for the first time. Some of those folks are resonating more and looking for a change in the Senate race. But as Scott mentioned, the polling indicates, you know, strong favorability for Feinstein. So we'll be watching this ahead. She seems to have a pretty substantial cushion right now, but we're still, you know, a little less than a month away.
Right. And Scott, there's one thing we haven't talked about that has come up in our conversations here in Southern California, which is that there is a measure on the ballot to repeal a gas tax that may actually play a role in getting people out to the polls.
Well, that's what Republicans were hoping, Jeremy. They put Prop 6 on the ballot. In fact, John Cox, the Republican candidate for governor, really funded that drive to collect the signatures, put it on the ballot. Polling shows it's not as popular as you might expect because, you know, everyone pays the gas tax if you drive. No one's particularly happy about having to pay it. It's about a 12 cents per gallon tax. But it generates $5 billion a year for transportation, roads, bridges, highways. And so the No on 6 campaign's done, I think, a pretty good job of saying they're trying to take away money to keep our highways and our infrastructure in good shape.
Well, and that's the thing that the experts have said for a long time is if you want, you know, the roads to be in good shape, if you want more money for transportation, you've got to raise the gas tax. But I will say, unlike on the East Coast, where I'm paying something like $2.60 a gallon, here I've seen gas stations that are over $4 a gallon. So we'll see how that plays out. Scott Schaefer at KQED and Mary Plummer here at KPCC. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're following Hurricane Michael, which is bearing down on the Florida Panhandle. The National Hurricane Center is calling Michael a potentially catastrophic storm. Florida Governor Rick Scott said Michael is the worst storm the Panhandle has seen in a century. Michael is so strong that it's expected to remain a hurricane as it passes over land and heads toward Georgia and the Carolinas, which are still recovering from Hurricane Florence. Well, if you think you've heard the last public radio story about the invasive Asian carp, think again. The species has been a problem in the U.S. for decades, and it isn't going away. The federal government has focused most of its work on keeping the carp out of the Great Lakes to protect the region's multi-billion-dollar fishing industry. But the fish have also started showing up in states as far south as Tennessee. Jay Shaw from member station WPLN reports the state's wildlife agency has its own plan to keep the carp contained.
Even the tiniest noise can startle the silver carp, causing it to jump 6 or 8 feet into the air. That's why the bow fishermen at this night tournament on a lake at the Tennessee-Kentucky border are keeping a low profile. They rely on ambient light from the moon and a quiet electric motor to get close to the carp. Then they pull back the arrow on their bow and... The carp tend to be black, white, and gray, so the only thing the fishermen can see at night are the fish's white lips.
They will be just swimming around right underneath the water's edge, and they'll be opening that big mouth. It looks like you're coming up on a 5-gallon bucket that's under the water.
That's Dustin Apple. He's been bow fishing for nearly 3 decades, and for the tournament, he's going after the 4 types of Asian carp: grass, black, silver, and big head.
Just kind of hit them wherever you can. Once it's in there, whether it's 8 pounds or 80 pounds, it's a pretty good fight. They run hard and they pull hard, and you can wear yourself out a night shooting big hits.
Asian carp were introduced to the U.S. in the 1960s and 70s to control algae blooms and parasites in fish farms. But some carp escaped and made their way into the Mississippi River Delta in the late 80s and early 90s. From there, they slowly migrated into Tennessee waters. Joe Nichols hosts fishing tournaments like the bow fishing one on a regular basis. He's seen firsthand the damage Asian carp can do.
Over 18 years of me doing this, I've seen them evolve. It's like a plague. I hate to say it that way, but that's literally how it is for our water systems.
The carp are aggressive growers. They eat the plankton that's at the bottom of the food chain for many native species. When they move in, they pretty much starve out the other fish in the ecosystem. They're also a threat to boaters. They can weigh up to 60 pounds, and when they jump, they can hurt passengers, skiers, and damage equipment. So Tennessee's Wildlife Resources Agency, the TWRA, is trying to control the Asian carp population. They're taking advantage of a growing commercial fishing industry that harvests the carp to turn into fertilizer.
It was only 3-4 years ago they were harvesting fish in the tens of thousands of pounds a year. And then soon it was hundreds of thousands of pounds a year. Now they're talking millions, you know, getting over a million, 2 million.
That's Frank Fitz, chief of fisheries for the TWRA. He says the agency will spend $500,000 to develop new markets for the carp beyond fertilizer, like getting more of them into restaurants. But all this would do is keep the population down. Keeping it from spreading is a different challenge. Fitz says Tennessee and Kentucky are working with the federal government to test out new technology to keep the carp contained.
They're bringing in sound barriers to test at the Barkley Dam to see if we can keep fish from coming in. And if that's successful, then we have a tool that we can use strategically throughout the whole basin.
The sound barrier plays loud noises and scares the fish away from dam locks, keeping them from moving further into the river system. All of these efforts, the new technology, the harvest incentives, and the fishing tournaments, will get expensive. And because the Asian carp problem is considerably worse in some northern states, that's where the federal government has focused most of its attention. Mike Butler is the CEO of Tennessee Wildlife Federation, a nonprofit conservation group. He says there needs to be a discussion about how the U.S. government distributes aid.
In terms of federal funding to address this, Illinois gets most of the money to address Asian carp, and they've got a pretty significant challenge trying to keep them out of the Great Lakes. Now, I think that moving forward, there's got to be some support given to the southeastern states that are dealing with this challenge, like Kentucky and Tennessee and some others.
Congress recently passed a bill with about $11 million to manage the carp population, but it's unclear how much of that goes to states in the South. And even with the funding, the problem for states like Tennessee is not going to be solved quickly.
Oh, here we go!
Hit the cameraman! Nailed me right in the back.
Did he?
Oh, yeah.
Back at the tournament, boats and fishermen came back from the lake with their haul. About 17,000 pounds of carp. But that's just a drop in the bucket. Not enough to make a dent in the overall population of Asian carp in Tennessee. As for now, all the state officials and fishermen can do is hold the line and keep the problem from getting worse. For Here and Now, I'm Jay Shaw.
So, Peter, we are continuing to monitor Hurricane Michael along the Gulf Coast of Florida there. Here in California, we continue our broadcast. I have to say one thing about the weather here that I have forgotten after having not lived here for several years.
Don't tell me, please.
Hot during the day, and then as soon as it cools, as soon as it gets dark out, it's like freezing cold. You need a sweater.
I'm looking 68 and sunny right now, is all I can see. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.